going to get a little weird this hour, so that's going to be a problem. Maybe you want to sit down because it's going to get weird. Weird questions with Jimmy Akin, something we do every now and then because we get weird questions here. And our guest, of course, when we do weird questions with Jimmy Akin is Jimmy Akin.
That's not very weird. No, that's what you'd expect.
You're right. We should call it weird questions with somebody with Dick Cavett.
Yeah.
And then it'll be you.
Yeah.
That would be weirder. Yes. Yeah. Excellent point, Jimmy Akin. Thanks for coming back.
Speaking of weird things, I had a little thing I was thinking about. I was doing some show prep before this hour, and I was thinking about the fact, you know, we took a question at the end of last hour about how God dealt with the Israelites, kind of like a parent deals with a child. And as a child matures, you deal with children differently because they can handle more responsibility and so forth. And I was thinking, that got me to thinking about a line in St. Paul where St. Paul talks about how we eagerly await our adoption as sons of God, and a son is a child until the time determined by the father. And to a modern person, that can sound weird because it's like, well, you're an adult as soon as you're 18. Not in the ancient world. In the ancient world, in Roman culture, the father of the household, the paterfamilias, decided when you were an adult. And so the father could do it early if someone matured early.
Mm-hmm.
He could do it late if they matured late.
Yeah.
But it was up to him to make that determination. And there was a special ceremony because, you know, humans like rites of passage.
Boy, do we. Yes, right.
Special ceremonies. And so there was a special ceremony where for the first time, and then this is in Roman society, but you would... when you got the right to become a man, you would like shave your beard for the first time. And you also got to put on what was called your toga virilis.
Manly toga.
Yeah. Except the way I've seen it translated in some English translations is you'll have people saying, I really want to put on my manly gown.
It's like, that kind of takes something out of it.
Yeah, I know, but I just love that. So that's the weird thing I was thinking about people in ancient Rome wanting to put on their manly gowns.
In the modern context, that means something else. I got something weird for you.
Okay.
Okay, so we were talking, who knows why, we just get onto these things. We were talking about whether if you buy a live chicken, not a live chicken, mm-hmm. but if you buy a live
buy a
chicken.
Whole chicken.
If you buy a whole chicken at the store.
Does it have a gizzard?
Still had gizzards. And Danielle emailed, apparently urgently, to radio at Catholic.com. And she said, please tell Cy and Jimmy they need to have Carlo Broussard bring them to South Louisiana. Enter any grocery store and they'll find gizzards, livers, hearts, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So,
cool.
Liver is often part of plate lunches. Oh, I love Southern plate lunches. We always put gizzards in our gumbo and we love gizzard and chicken heart stew.
Uh-huh.
So we stand corrected. Well, I don't know if we didn't say you don't get them. We just said we didn't know if you still get them.
You asked a question.
Yeah. And by the way, in Southern Louisiana there, Danielle, things may be entirely different there than they are here in the Republic of California. Because who knows what's legal here and what's not at any given time.
Yeah.
You never know. They probably have to put a special label on it.
Okay. Yeah, like you can't have gerbils here.
Is that really true? You can't have gerbils?
Yeah, I looked into it because I had a gerbil as a kid and I liked having a gerbil and I thought about getting one as a pet, not in California.
I did know you can't have a weasel or what's the other name for a weasel? A ferret.
Really?
You can't have.
It's crazy.
What? Why is this? You can't have weasels or ferrets?
Ferrets are fun. They do the weasel war dance.
That's exactly right. But it's a state of laws. Like they think of something and they just make a law against it. You can't do that. No, you can't do that here. All right, Jimmy, you ready for some weird questions?
Yeah.
All right, let's start with Abraham.
Okay.
This is not the original Abraham. I think he's named after the original Abraham.
Mm.
Is there anything in tradition or scripture, and he capitalized both of those, that points to a man as God's closest and favorite creature to the extent that there may be other life forms in existence superior to us in every way, except in our closeness to God's heart? What an interesting question.
So in terms of material creation, we do have an indication that man is favored by God in a way that no other earthly creature is, because when you look at the days of creation in Genesis 1, you have God repeatedly declaring creation on what he's made to be good. But then when he makes man, he declares it very good.
Ah.
So that's an indication that that man is special in a way other earthly creatures aren't. The problem here is we're talking about the planet Earth. So we don't know. He could have other people on other planets that are special to him too. In terms of could we be special to him in a way that other even superior creatures aren't, the answer to that would seem to be yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because the angels are superior to us. They're more powerful than we are. They are naturally immortal in a way we're not. They are smarter than we are. So the angels are superior to us, and we do read in Scripture that we're made lower than the angels. Nevertheless, God chose to become incarnate as one of us and to redeem us from sin. Whereas, the book of Jude points out, he did not stoop to pick up angels when they fell. And so that suggests humans are favored in a way that angels are not, even though angels are superior to us in several respects. So you put those together, those two things together, and I couldn't rule out that there are aliens out there who are superior to us, and we might still have a specially favored relationship with God. We'll have to wait till we meet such aliens to figure that out.
All right, Abraham. Thank you very, very much for that question. I wonder if aliens would look like us. I think they would look pretty much like us. Mm-hmm.
Some of them might. The body form we have is one that is successful for intelligent creatures. You need good eyes.
Yeah.
And a manipulator ability like the opposable thumb, and also something like a tongue to be able to, like our tongue, to be able to communicate effectively through language. Now, there are other ways of doing this, but this is a successful body form. It could be similar to, it could be used by other intelligent creatures in the universe, but they also could look really different from us.
I guess so. I hope they're not blobs if we do meet them.
What you got against blobs?
I don't know. I just seems weird talking to a blob.
No, I think we should think about this blob prejudice.
I definitely have speciesism. Yeah, that's what I meant. Mitch asks, how did they keep time in the New Testament times?
Well, did it in a variety, and 6-8, yeah. They did it in a variety of different ways. Obviously, it depends on the time scale you're measuring. In terms of the day, you know, they used the same system that we do. Is this, you know, when does the sun come up and when does it go down and stuff? So they would measure days that way. They would also divide the days into different units, like hours, or in the nighttime, watches. And these units could sometimes be determined, you know, what time it was during the day could sometimes be determined either by the position of the sun in the sky or by like a sundial.
Mm-hmm.
The water clock, I believe, had been invented by this time, but it wasn't yet reliable.
Mm-hmm.
I know candles were used later on. Because you could tell how, you know, if you know this standardized candle, how long it's going to burn. But I don't know for a fact that those were used in the first century. At nighttime, you would determine things by the position of the moon and the stars. And the moon is also how they determine the months in Israel. Their month began every new moon.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a special procedure that we still have the laws for. At Jerusalem, at the beginning of every month, you would have these guys who had sharp eyesight.
Yeah.
And they would come and testify to the priests that we just saw the new moon. And then the priests would issue a declaration. And so everyone who was connected with Jerusalem, now this didn't apply to distant Jewish colonies like Alexandria.
Right.
But everyone in the Jerusalem area would say, okay, it's now this month.
Yeah.
And they had special procedures. Because the new moon was ritually important. It was one of the Jewish festivals, was the new moon festival. And so because of its ritual importance, they had these tests that they would use to examine the witnesses. So like if you didn't have just one witness, you had to have multiple witnesses say we saw the new moon.
Wow.
And there were certain restrictions on who could serve as a witness. And then they would have these examination questions like, okay, you saw the new moon. which way did the curve go? Because it's always the same way when the moon is waxing rather than waning.
Oh.
And if he says the wrong direction,
then you kill him.
Discount his testimony.
Oh, okay, I thought we were going to kill him.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's how they would determine the months, and then the annual cycles were determined partly by arrival of the crops, also by the position of the stars. In fact, in Egypt, where they have basically three seasons, inundation, emergence, and summer, the inundation season is when the Nile rises and then fertilizes the Nile Valley so they can plant their crops. Emergence is when the water recedes, so the land reappears, and then summer is when it's dry. The flooding of the Nile annually occurs right after the appearance of the star Sirius over the horizon.
Right.
And so they'd watch for Sirius and know inundation's about to happen, and that was effectively one of their New Year's.
What an interesting question. Thank you very, very much for that question, Mitch. Now we know how they kept time in the New Testament times. Speaking of New Testament times, I wonder what the early church was like.
Well, here's someone who can answer that question for us, Si.
I want to follow up real quick on Jimmy's discussion of time here. So the laborers in the vineyard in our Lord's parable there's a few who just, you know, at the end, work a couple hours at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But of course, in our translation, hours may mean something different here than 60 minutes.
It means approximately the same thing, but they didn't. The watches of the night were longer than an hour. But the daytime hours were meant to be what we would think of as an hour. But in practice, it varied because if you divide the unit, the daytime, into 12 units, then how long those units are will depend on how close you are to the winter solstice versus the summer solstice,
right.
Because the daytime changes length.
Right. Yeah.
Excellent question, Chris Check.
Fascinating.
President of Catholic Answers. But like, okay, so look, if you got to wait for people to say new moon to get new month, how do you know which day the rent is due on? Like, do you think that they didn't pay rent? Like, they must have been rent, right? Or no? Maybe that was invented later.
No, they did have rent, and I know they had rent in the Roman world. I'm sure they had it in the Jewish world too.
If there was currency, it was rent.
It would depend. It would depend on what you had agreed with your landlord.
Yeah, I guess so. All right. So, Chris.
You're going to have a hard time segueing here. So let's just go straight to it, Si.
Okay.
We're here to tell people to come to our conference. We're here to invite them to come to our conference.
Yes.
CatholicAnswersConference.com. This year, the theme is the early church was the Catholic Church. So the apostolic and patristic age. All of the things that we see in their fruition now, we find the origins of, and with the expression of, I guess would be a better way to say it, in the early church. So, for example, Carlo Broussard will be talking about all the sacraments, so all seven of them, how we find, how we locate them
in the early church.
Yeah.
That's September 26th through 29th right here at the Hyatt Regency La Jolla in beautiful and sunny San Diego. As Chris said, CatholicAnswersConference.com is where you go to sign up.
I know Jimmy is going to be talking about a topic that you just did a CD set on, right?
Yeah, popular CD set.
Yeah, if you go to shop.catholic.com, you can get a preview of the conference. Jimmy's going to be talking about the Apostolic Fathers, or what you call the very first fathers.
Yeah.
So give us a little preview.
Oh, you mean right now?
Okay,
I thought you were saying go to the shop.
Okay.
To get the
preview. Yeah. Okay. No. Yeah. No. That's fine.
Oh yeah. Nope. Sure. No. These are the guys who either lived during the age of the apostles or immediately afterwards. So they were closely connected with the apostles. That's why they're called the Apostolic Fathers. I'm also going to be talking about some other writings that aren't technically by fathers, but were written in the same period, including the first surviving church rule book.
Oh.
Is
that the Didache?
That's the Didache. Yeah, okay. And also a private revelation from the first century that we had. It's a massive private revelation that we still have the text of.
That someone should use to make a movie. They should use it as a script for a movie.
Exciting dragon defeating scene.
Yeah, come on.
That makes me want to sign up.
You should sign up. Well, you are signed up.
Of the events that we do, the conference is my favorite. We get almost 1,000 people to it, and there's nothing I love more than throwing a party and it's like a giant party.
Oh, and speaking of that, I'm calling dancing at it, so we'll be partying that way, too.
In fact, there is a party atmosphere in that regard, so Jimmy will be calling square dancing. Tim Staples, Carlo Broussard, Trent Horn, but we've got some great special guests as well.
Monsignor Eugene Morris,
among them. He is a powerful speaker.
So
magnificent.
We need to get him to dance, so it'll be Morris dancing.
Oh, that's right. We got to do that. And we'll get Father David McConey to dance, too. It'll be McConey dance.
Father David McConey is one of the leading authorities on St. Augustine, teaches at St. Louis University.
Does the patristic age close with Augustine, or is that just kind of...
No.
Gregory the Great?
In the East. In the West, it's Isidore of Seville.
Okay, fair enough.
So even past
Rod Bennett's going to be there.
Rod Bennett, who did a book for us called The Apostasy That Wasn't, is going to be showing, exposing some of those Protestant myths about the early church.
You usually try to get a good bishop or cardinal or something.
And this year we have a man whom Bishop Conley says is the best speaker in the whole USCCB. And that is Bishop Frank Caggiano of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Right.
And in fact, he is my brother's bishop, Father Paul Check. And Father Paul Check is on the program too. He's going to be doing two special lunches of spiritual direction. So one on the moral life and one on the spiritual life.
And your brother is the perfect guy to do that.
He is very good at it.
He is wonderful when he talks.
He is the one that my parents put all their effort into.
I have to say, he gave a talk on the cruise where we went to Canada that is one of the best things I have ever heard given. Yeah. It was beautiful. It was on Jesus and on
suffering.
Suffering and failure in the life of Jesus.
Failure, and
it was unbelievably good. All right, you can get special early bird pricing right now through July 2nd, so get your tickets soon. Seats are limited. That is an empirical fact. Seats are limited. Full conference ticket includes banquet dinner with keynote address by Bishop Caggiano, and there's a special room rate still available. Erica, you still got some rooms available at $154 a night? Two thumbs up.
That is a bargain at that hotel. This is a nearly empirical fact. The end of San Diego. The end of September is almost the best time to. It may be the best time to come to San Diego,
right?
Because it's still the weather is perfect and the crowds are gone.
And sometimes there's an air show.
Yeah.
CatholicAnswersConference.com. CatholicAnswersConference.com.
All right, Catholic back to work.
Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
He was a pope, a saint, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Pope St. Gregory I the Great is one of only four popes honored as the Great. Among his many achievements was sending missionaries across Northern Europe, especially St. Augustine of Canterbury, who brought Christ to the people of England. In a pun, Pope Gregory called the English people angels. He died in 604.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
That was Matthew Bunsen. We haven't had him on it for a long time. We got to have him to do church in the news or that kind of thing. He's really good. Right now we got Jimmy Akin. So
we just had Chris Check.
Yeah.
And I liked how he said initially we're here to tell you to come to our conference. And then he corrected it to we're here to invite you.
Yeah.
And so it's like that's a politer way to say tell. And so I was just thinking if you want to be like really polite with your two-year-old, you can invite them not to run out in the street.
Yes, I'm inviting you to not run out in the street in an extremely loud, shrieking, panicked voice.
Yeah.
That would be good. It is fun to try to reason with two-year-olds, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as long as their life is not on the line.
Yeah, their favorite word is no.
Yeah, well, then... I always found that they love the word no at three. People talk about the terrible twos, but three is, I don't know what the terrible three or something. Mm-hmm. Let's go to
Thuffer and Thuckatash.
Thuffer and Thuckatash. It's weird questions, by the way, with Jimmy Akin. Paul asks the following question, Jimmy. Did Jesus die to save extraterrestrials too?
We don't know. Partly that depends on a couple of things. One is it depends on God's intention. That's the fundamental thing it depends on. You could make an argument. It also depends on are there extraterrestrials? And here we're talking about intelligent beings, I assume, not right. microbes on Mars and stuff. Although I think there are microbes on Mars.
Ew.
Yeah, I think it's a germy planet.
That's gross.
There are a couple of theological dimensions to this that are relevant. The first one is the fact that Jesus' sacrifice was infinite in value because he's God and he's infinite, and so his sacrifice had infinite value. And as a consequence of that, his sacrifice was certainly sufficient to cover the sins of aliens if there are aliens and if they have sins.
Okay.
However, it's also sufficient to cover the sins of angels.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't apply to angels. As we mentioned, Jude says God didn't stoop to pick up angels when they fell. Now, if you look in the catechism has a theological explanation for why it doesn't apply to angels. It says that it's not because the mercy of God is limited. It's because the way angels' consciousness works, they made their decision all at once at the beginning of their existence, mm-hmm. and they don't change after that.
Right.
Whereas we have a period over the course of our earthly life where we can go back and forth, and then whatever our final answer is becomes fixed at the point of our death. We won't change our minds after that. We'll either be friends with God and we'll like that,
yep.
or we'll not be friends with God, and that's our choice too.
We won't
repent though and say, "Well, I want to be his friend now."
Yeah.
So there's certainly enough value in Christ's sacrifice to cover all angels, but it may or may not apply to them, depending, among other things, on God's intent and on how their minds work.
Extraterrestrials.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would suspect that because they're likely to be changeable like we are in their decisions, at least during their physical lives, I would suspect that the thing that prevents it from being effective for angels would not prevent it from being effective for them. However, that still leaves us with the question of God's intent. Also, even if God intended to have Christ's sacrifice here on earth be sufficient for them and applicable to them, that doesn't mean he didn't also incarnate on their planet and maybe die for them there too as a demonstration of his love for them. Because the cross wasn't the only time Jesus suffered in his life. Jesus suffered many times during his life.
Right.
And all of those instances of Jesus suffering have a certain redemptive aspect to them. And so if Jesus, even though he only died once here on earth, I can't rule out that God didn't choose to also have him die elsewhere as a demonstration of his redemptive love for others. I'm not saying he did.
No.
I'm just saying I can't rule it out.
All right. Thank you very much, Paul, for that question. Again, it's a weird question.
Oh, one last little dimension of that.
Yeah.
Some people will interpret Jesus' death as having a relationship not just with mankind, but the entire cosmos, the entire physical world. And if that's the case, that would be an additional argument for his death having some relevance to extraterrestrials.
I gotcha. Up next is a question from William. I have seen this question before, William.
Hmm.
How many angels can dance on the head of a pin?
As many as God wants. That's the simple answer. The reason for that is because angels do not natively occupy space. So for an angel to dance, mm-hmm. it would have to manifest in some way mm-hmm. Through an angelophany. Mm-hmm. Which is a fancy way of saying an angel manifesting.
Yeah.
And so angels, you know, do manifest. They do have physical effects in the Bible. But however many God wants would be able to do it, because that physical manifestation, number one, could be small. There's no limit to how small it could be. I mean, maybe the Planck length would limit how small an angel's physical manifestation could be. But even then, that wouldn't determine the number of angels, because it's only the electromagnetic force of the universe that prevents two objects from existing in the same space at the same time. It's not gravity. It's the fact that the outer shells of atoms are made of electrons and they repel each other. And so that's keeping things apart. But angels could overlap with each other. Their manifestations might not be electromagnetic.
William, thanks for asking that question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. We got a whole bunch, and some of them get a little weirder. We'll be right back with more Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
In his new audio presentation, The Very First Fathers, apologist Jimmy Akin takes you on a tour of the earliest Christian writings outside the New Testament, from the most famous figures and most notable works to those lesser known but no less important. This pivotal time in the development of the early church is revealed in fascinating detail. Jimmy shows how, even in the first century after the resurrection, it was necessary to defend and explain truths that are still under attack today, such as the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist and the perpetual virginity of Mary. The Very First Fathers is a compelling look at the dawn of the Christian age and edifying listening for anyone who wants to understand and defend the full truth of Catholicism. Order your copy of The Very First Fathers today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Looking for an on-fire Catholic speaker for your event? Catholic Answers speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
Monday on More to Life. Feeling selfish?
How can we have a healthy relationship with our needs and wants? We're going to help you make a godly response to the desires of your heart.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's weird time. We got weird questions for Jimmy Akin. We'll see if the answers are weird. So far, I don't know that the answers have been all that weird.
Really evaluate question answers along the is it weird or not axis.
No, I'm still not happy about your response to me that they could be blobs if there's extraterrestrials.
Said could be. I didn't say are.
I know. I just find it weird.
In fact, I would argue that intelligent aliens are unlikely to be blobs.
Thank you for saying that. I feel much better now.
The reason is that they, in order to drive the development of intelligence from a biological perspective, you need the ability to easily interact with your environment. So you need the ability to move around, you need the ability to manipulate things, and all of that is in, you need the ability to communicate, and all of that suggests a sophisticated anatomy that simply isn't like a blob. However, they could be like Shoggoths and be blobs that have the ability to form temporary appendages enabling them to interact with their environment and communicate and things like that.
I didn't think you could make it creepier. I didn't think it could get creepier, but Seamus asked this, Jimmy. Was the apparition that St. Paul had on the road to Damascus a private or public revelation?
Depends on how you're going to define your terms. Private and public revelation are theological terms. They don't come from the Bible. And so they really mean what theologians use them to mean. Mm-hmm. And there's some dissatisfaction with the term private revelation because it's kind of ambiguous. Mm-hmm. I know I've seen in Fischischella's Dictionary of Fundamental Theology in his entry on... I think it's by René Latourelle. In the entry on private revelation, there's like a proposed alternative. It's something like a special revelation or something like that. If one of the things you find, and it's kind of interesting. Now, the Bible is all public revelation, but that doesn't mean the Bible can't record instances of private revelation. It just means when it does so, these are true. And so you will find theologians like René Latourelle and Avery Dulles. He talks about this in his book on Revelation, at least he mentions it briefly, that the Bible does seem to contain incidents of private revelation. It does talk about them. And so if you, unless you say everything that the Bible mentions has to be a public revelation by definition, then it would look like, no, what happened with St. Paul here has a private aspect to it. Jesus appeared to Paul, not to people in general. And in fact, the people who were with Paul only had a partial experience mm-hmm. of what Paul was experiencing. They could like hear a voice but not understand it. They could see a light, but they didn't see Jesus himself. So they had a partial experience of it, but this was really meant for Paul. And although Paul later disclosed certain things about what Jesus said to him, we don't know everything he said. He might have said additional things. He might have had additional insights all supernaturally, all in an instant, that couldn't even be expressed in words necessarily.
Yeah.
And so so I would say, based on a natural use of the term, that this would count as a private revelation because it had this private dimension to it. But the fact of this private revelation is guaranteed in public revelation, which also contains some details about the private revelation.
Okay, so what the public revelation is the book of Acts.
Yeah, yeah. In the Bible.
Right,
like
right.
The rest of the Bible's public revelation.
Yeah, I gotcha. Okay. Seamus, thank you very much for that question. Stephen asks this. Do the promises of Jesus's return and other associated events give us ancillary assurance that the human race will not first be totally wiped out by some other disaster, such as a planet-killing asteroid or biological superweapon?
Yeah, I've actually thought about this since my childhood, and I think the answer is yes. The fact that Jesus is going to return before the end of the human race means the human race will not be entirely extinguished by any future disaster prior to the second coming. However, that doesn't mean large chunks of the mm-hmm. human race will not be extinguished mm-hmm. by a nuclear war or a quantum black hole or a strange lit impact or
the
any number of
the list can stop now.
Okay. Like, or a virus.
Okay. I mean, so, I didn't even know that there was such a thing as a quantum black hole, and now I'm nervous about it. Thanks.
Well, you really shouldn't need to worry about it because they're okay. So small they can't really suck up much mass. It would be improbable for one of them to grow large enough to actually threaten the Earth.
That's what I was hoping.
On the other hand, a strange lit, if you have like even a little bit of strange matter, we're in big trouble. but so lots of people right. could die. Right. But not all. And so that's, there is some reassurance in that. Not everybody will be dead at the time of the second coming.
This did happen in human history once, right? That the human race was devastated.
At least once, and possibly more than once. Those are what are referred to as population bottlenecks. Yeah. And we have genetic evidence. Now, some people will look at Noah's Ark and say, oh, population bottleneck.
Yeah.
But it may not have been a universal flood.
Oh,
and also, we're in an area of Genesis where there's a high level of symbolism being used. So, you know, you have to be a little careful here because history is not being written the same way according to the same conventions that it's that are used later on in the Bible. But we have evidence from human DNA that indicates that the human race at one time had gotten down to just a few thousand people, like 10 or 20,000, and that was all. And everyone who's alive today is descended from them.
That's a close call. Stephen, thanks very much. Very, very interesting question. Oh, another. This is Steve, not Stephen. Can a priest give himself confession? If a priest lives in an extremely remote location, far from any other priest, and he commits a mortal sin, does he get an exception to the prohibition to receive the Eucharist since he must receive as part of the Mass? Or can we stop working on the document? I'm trying to read it.
Yeah, I don't.
The document's being edited as I'm reading it. Or does he have a special means to temporarily give himself confession?
So Stephen is right, or Steve, whichever it is,
Steve is
right that a priest is absolutely required to receive communion at Mass. He is not to celebrate Mass if he's not going to receive communion. So that does result in there being situations like this. I know, for example, St. Damian de Wooster, of Molokai.
Right.
You know, he's here at this leper colony in this remote Hawaiian island. He doesn't get a chance to hang out with other priests very much. And so, like, there was one incident in his life where he needed to go to confession and there's another priest, but he's sailing away on a boat. And so you have St. Damian shouting his confession to the departing priest in a language that the other people don't speak.
Oh, yeah.
And at least that's the story. But there actually are provisions for this.
Yeah.
So, and they don't just apply to priests. A person, the fundamental condition for receiving communion is you need to be in a state of grace. And so if you haven't been able to go to sacramental confession, which is the ordinary way of returning to a state of grace, you can also return to a state of grace through making an act of perfect contrition, which reconciles you with God even before you have the opportunity to go to confession. And so what happens is, in the case of a priest who needs to celebrate Mass but can't go to confession first, he needs to make an act of perfect contrition with, you know, the intent to go to confession as soon as it's reasonable, and he and that will enable him to go ahead and celebrate Mass. Same thing applies to us. Now, we're not required to receive communion at Mass.
Yeah.
Which is something a lot of people don't seem to realize. You don't have to receive communion at Mass. You don't have to receive communion to fulfill your Sunday obligation. You're totally, I mean, you need to receive once a year, but you don't have to receive every time you go to Mass. So we don't have need to go to Mass as an excuse enabling us to do this. But if there's some grave necessity, like danger of death or something else, then that option is available to us as well. We can go ahead and make an act of perfect contrition with the intent of going to confession as soon as it's reasonably possible, and go ahead and receive, because there's a grave necessity to do so in this case.
All right. Steve, thanks for that. I had an image in my mind of Father Damian making his confession while everyone else is listening, like, I stole that guy's soup. Yeah. And then that guy over there, I just can't stand him. Oh, sorry, everybody. Okay, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more weird
questions
with Jimmy Akin right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you want to end abortion? Halt the attack on traditional marriage? And ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Forget Catholic Answers Magazine. It's on sale right now. $10 off a one-year subscription, $20 off a two-year subscription, $5 off the all-digital subscription. You just go over to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com, and you'll find everything you need there to get a subscription. CatholicAnswersMagazine.com. It's a big sale. $10 off on 1 year, $20 off 2 years. That's pretty good. Let's go to Mark's question now. It's weird questions for Jimmy Akin. Mark says, if Jesus could heal the Roman soldier's child from a distance, and Jesus gave the power to forgive sins, then why can't the priest absolve someone from a distance?
So there are two possible answers to this. One is because it's impossible for him to do so, that the sacraments intrinsically require personal presence, or at least that this sacrament intrinsically requires personal presence. And the second possible answer is because the law presently does not permit him to.
Oh.
And I think there's an interesting case to be made that it's the second answer that's correct.
Oh.
That hypothetically, if a priest, if the law were different, that priests would be able to absolve people at a distance. And the reason I say that is because there is another sacrament where it is possible to have the sacrament performed at a distance without personal presence there. And that sacrament is matrimony.
Mm-hmm.
The way the law is written, and so, you know, that's what I'm basing this on, but the way the law is written, you can have the parties exchange consent in front of a minister, even if one of them is not there, via proxy.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah. So marriage by proxy is, which is not very common, but it is historically done.
Mm-hmm.
Marriage by proxy is actually allowed by canon law. And so that would suggest that personal presence is not required for the sacrament of matrimony. And even then, you know, it's a question of how close do you got to be?
Yeah.
You know, right. I mean, if I'm 150 feet away, but I'm still shouting my consent to the marriage, is that okay? Well, what right. if I'm 151 feet away?
Yeah.
You know, really, this sacrament involves, the exchange of consent involves the transmission of information. It's not like Holy Communion, where you have to receive in your mouth.
Right.
Or anointing of the sick, where you have to touch someone to anoint them.
Right.
So really, matrimony is an information-based sacrament where the matter is provided by the exchange of information. And I would argue, reasoning in a parallel fashion, the same thing is true of confession. Because the priest never has to touch you during confession.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems that the matter of the sacrament is provided by the exchange of information. And if you can have a proxy, you know, serving to convey the information in a marriage, so you don't have to personally be there, I would assume in principle the same thing is going to be true of confession. And in fact, I can even cite a precedent for this from the history of sacramental theology. If you read Moral and Pastoral Theology by Henry Davis, who was a Jesuit in the 1930s, he wrote this four-volume manual on moral and pastoral theology. You look in the section on confession, he considers the question, can you confess by telephone? And he concludes, now this is not what the law is today.
Okay. So,
right. And there are good reasons for this.
So could we call this a speculation?
But yeah.
Okay.
But he thinks you can. And
uh-huh.
so he actually thinks you can confess over the telephone in the right situation. I would have a hard time justifying that outside of danger of death.
Yeah.
But he thinks that it will be valid if you confess over the telephone. And so he seems to have the same information-based understanding of the matter that doesn't require immediate personal presence. So I would think there's a significant case to be made that personal presence isn't required for the matter of confession to be valid, just the information getting there as via proxy,
yeah,
or proxy technology that conveys it, could be sufficient.
Uh-huh. Very interesting. I can't. Yeah.
Oh, and do not try to confess by telephone, because it's not secure, if for no other reason apart from doubts about the validity of the matter in this case. It's also not secure, and the NSA is listening, and you don't need them to know what your sins are.
I stole this guy's soup.
I'm a little amazed that Davis even suggested this in the 1930s. I mean, that was the era when party lines were common.
Oh, yeah.
And anybody could pick up the phone and listen to what you were saying.
Right. To which party are you calling?
Yeah.
Here's the thing. Okay, since it's a weird question, yeah, I'm going to push this a little further. Say I'm the Pope and I'm the legislator and I get to decide this. I wouldn't allow it now because I don't think it would be trustworthy. Mm-hmm. Like, there's the technology is getting so advanced in mimicking voice and video and everything. How could you ever be certain that you really are engaging with another person? You see what I'm saying? Like,
you're worried about deepfakes.
Yeah, deepfakes. That's the word, right? Yeah.
Well, I would say the scenario you're imagining is, let's say I'm the penitent.
Yeah.
And I contact the church via electronic means.
Right.
And how do I know the priest I'm talking to is not a deepfake?
Yeah.
That is a computer simulated human that is indistinguishable from real one. Well, for one thing, right now they can't pass the Turing test. The Turing test is where you can't distinguish a human from an artificial intelligence based on interacting with them.
And they can't.
You look at what chatbots are doing right now, and they cannot be passed for human. In fact, I was just looking at a video. I put it on Facebook, a video of an animated video of a story that was written by an AI.
Oh, yeah?
And it was completely ridiculous. I mean, it's just a terrible story. It's hilarious to watch it because the AI is like...
find that.
The AI is incorporated like all of the Star Wars movies and all of the Harry Potter books and a bunch of things by other people, and then tried based on that to write a story.
Yeah.
And so you're going along and this is a ridiculous, terrible story. And then all of a sudden, Hagrid the Table shows up and starts talking to people. And so in my comment, I said, Hagrid is clearly destined to be the fan favorite character from this AI
Hagrid
story.
Hagrid the Table.
So right now we do have confidence that the person we're talking to, if they are showing human interactions, that they're a real human being. It's also unlikely that why would someone want to deepfake you in confession?
Yeah, that's true.
Also,
unless they wanted to get my confession,
they could. But here's the thing: by the time AI is good enough to pass the Turing test, we're going to have the ability to make androids that are indistinguishable from human beings.
Oh yeah.
So how do you know if you go to a physical confessional? How do you know that you're not dealing with an android priest who's there to tape your confession?
I hate android priests.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I probably shouldn't use such strong language, but okay. I'm with you.
Yeah. So that problem will be solved when we get to it.
Don asks this. Why do we come on, Cyril. Don asks, why do we genuflect on the right knee, not the left?
It's a combination of two things. The fundamental answer is it's a matter of custom. But the reason for the custom is because most human beings are right-handed, and that results in right-hand dominance being socially preferred. And so when we transfer that to kneeling, under the influence of right-handed social dominance, that leads us to want to reserve the right knee for the most important sign of reverence and use the left knee for a lesser sign of reverence. So when we genuflect, we go down on the right knee because we're genuflecting to God, the most important person or set persons there are, and we reserve the left knee for like genuflecting to a head of state or something like the Queen of England, you're going to use your left knee. and because they're not as important as God. And so it's the desire to distinguish the reverence we show to God from the reverence we could show to another human being. And under the fact that most people are right-handed, we apply that to our knees. Although the fact your right hand may be dominant doesn't imply which leggedness you have. I have
really, Jimmy.
Yeah, I am dominantly right-handed, although I'm somewhat ambidextrous. I use my left hand for some things, but I know I'm left-footed.
Yeah,
and not just because I'm Catholic. the reason I know that
a
the reason
left-footer. I wonder if people get that reference. It's an English slur for
Catholic.
Yeah, left-footer.
The idea there is you use your wrong foot when your left foot instead of your right foot when pushing down a shovel, and that's the stupid way to do it.
Oh,
but I was first identified as a left footer by my old chiropractor who looked at the wear patterns on my boot and said, "You're a left footer." And I had never known that. Some years ago, after he told me that, I was out in the parking lot here behind the Catholic Answers building, and I encountered a baby rattlesnake. And it was rattling at me. And my first thought was, there are women in this building who are wearing sandals. And my second thought was, what do you know? I am left-footed.
I had just stomped
on the baby rattlesnake with my boot. And then my third thought was, I just enacted my own personal version of Genesis 3:15 in the Proto-Evangelium.
Right, yes. You smited him.
Yeah,
you
struck at his head,
yes,
and he was striking at my heel, I'm sure, at the same time, but I had a boot on, so I won.
Karen wants to know this, Jimmy. Is it possible to determine Jesus' DNA from the shroud, from the holy face of Manopello, or from Eucharistic miracles?
So the church doesn't have a teaching in this area. And specifically, the church doesn't have a teaching about the authenticity of the shroud or the associated artifacts. This is in a different category than the Eucharistic miracles. But the fundamental answer is going to be the same. If these things are genuinely either in the case of the shroud, the burial cloth of Christ, or the cloth that was put over his face, or if this is a genuine manifestation of his physical body, as opposed to a miracle that conveys that appearance, but isn't identically the same thing, in all detail, then his human DNA would be present. And if it survived and is in sufficient quantity to be recoverable and testable, then hypothetically you could do that. In fact, I know there have been studies done on the blood on the shroud, not DNA level studies because we didn't have the technology to do DNA then, but blood typing studies. Mm-hmm. And they could identify the blood type. And it was a fairly rare one. So if these were authentic artifacts in the case of the shroud and the associated ones, and if Eucharistic miracles represent a manifestation of Jesus's body on the DNA level, mm-hmm. then you could hypothetically recover his DNA from that and sequence it.
Hmm.
Assuming there's enough there and it survived, because DNA does degrade over time. And it also can become hard to recover because of admixture with other people's DNA, like all the pilgrims who may have kissed the shroud over the centuries.
Right. As far as that blood type on the shroud, I'm just curious about this. Do you happen to know, I assume blood types and ethnicities might
be correlated?
Yeah, be somewhat correlated. Do you happen to know?
I don't in this case know what racial implications there might be for the blood type they found.
That's a lot of weird questions you did today.
Oh, we're done?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
if you like weird stuff, I've got this other thing we can recommend to you. I have this other podcast called Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Just today, we released an episode on a man named John Hendricks, also known as the Tennessee Prophet, who lived 100 years ago and made amazing predictions that came true.
Yeah. One of the things I like about it, Jimmy, is you're open-minded to so many things without being
credulous.
Sucker. Yeah.
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 I try not.
That's
I try
such
to be
a better word. Credulous.
I try to be open-minded, but not so much my brain falls out.
Yeah. Right. And you hold on to the things that are manifestly true. You know.
Yeah.
You're not slipping and sliding all over. Jimmy Akin, thank you for 2 great hours today. That was
my pleasure.
2 hours of work. Really appreciate it. That wraps it up for us for this work week. I want to remind you, there's all kinds of sales going on here. You can go over to shop.catholic.com and get $15, $10, $5, and $1 deals right now. You just go to shop.catholic.com. And the magazine's on sale. Catholic Answers Magazine is $10 off for a 1-year subscription, $20 for a 2-year subscription. Head over to catholicanswersmagazine.com to get that one.